Linda Hansen, Sheena, 1907.
Okay, we're glad you're with us here. With us this year, Amanda.
Dorothy Loftus, Fairbanks, 1907. 1906. You see now why we have such high respect for these ladies. There's a place for everything and everything in its place. Just like that. Now, other members of the organization not with us today are Agnes and Thomas, Fairbanks Pioneer Soul,
Ellen Carlisle, Columbus, Georgia,
Minnie Brewis in the Fairbanks Pioneer Home, Fanny Joyce of Taft, California, Louise Carstens, Fairbanks Pioneers Home, Charlotte Cuban. I'm sure somebody will tell me where Charlotte is located at present. Okay. Margaret Murray, Moose, Wyoming, Mildred Nerland. I don't believe Mildred is here today, but she lives in Fairbanks.
In Anchorage
today. Okay. Mary Joyce, Juneau. Henrietta DeRee, California. Lucy Bailey, Redwood City, California. Mary Foran, Seattle, Washington. Albina Miller, Washington, D.C. We'd also like to make acknowledgement that Igloo number 4 was chartered on August the 2nd, 1910. To the best of our records, only one charter member survived. That is Robert Bloom, who is now 95 years of age and who lives in Seattle. In past years, the Igloo has invited men and women who have lived many years in Alaska to be honored guests. Thus, 4 years ago, Interior Early Day Pioneer pilots were honored for their great contribution to the state of Alaska. 3 years ago, the Igloo selected for specific recognition those men who had served as president of Igloo number 4 and thereby greatly perpetuated the aims and objectives of Interior Alaska Pioneer. 2 years ago, recognition was given to early day Teamsters, the men who pioneered road transportation in Alaska and supplied communities, miners, and others with equipment and supplies. Last year, special recognition was given to early day gold miners who had worked mines in Interior Alaska. This year, the 71st anniversary of the finding of gold in the Fairbanks area by Felix Pedro, recognition is given to the early day farmers of Interior Alaska who worked the soil and provided vegetables and fruit for Interior Alaska people. In researching this group, many names were obtained of farmers in Interior Alaska during the first years of the century. Those present today are representing the many who have passed on, and certainly I am sure there are others to be added to the roster. Some of these you'll hear about a little later in the program. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you Charles Kramer. Charles was born the 4th of May, 1889 in Weaverville, California. He arrived in Dyea, Alaska in November 1897. He came to Fairbanks with his family in 1904, and his first job around Fairbanks was herding cattle for the Walker brothers on Ridgetop. Between 1908 and 1920, in addition to herding cattle which came by boat, then over the summer trail from Circle City or over the Valdez Trail, he delivered milk for the Hinckley Dairy, which he purchased from Charles Hinckley in 1928, approximately 300 acres along College Road. In addition, he acquired 480 acres along the Farmer's Loop. He married Anna Carr in Tacoma, Washington in October 1920, and they have one son, Donald, who resides in the Fairbanks area. Shortly after the passing of his wife in the fall of 1965, Kramer's Dairy closed. For more than 20 years, Kramer's Dairy also owned and operated a fire truck out of their yard, and this has certainly saved thousands of dollars for nearby residents. Over the years, many local people have looked forward to the arrival of ducks and geese in the spring of the year in the Kramer's hayfield. Charlie joined Igloo number 4, December 1928. On July 10, 1973, he became a resident of the Fairbanks Pioneers Home. It's with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce to you Charlie Kramer. Charlie, will you stand, please? With us today, he's either weathered in or weathered out, we haven't figured quite which, but this was Robert Busby. Bob was born in Fairbanks in June 1911 on one of the first homesteads in the interior to Harry and Louise Busby. One of four boys, he lived on the homestead until he went outside to school. When he returned in 1926, he continued to be active in farming. He operated a dairy for 5 years. In addition to homesteading at Mile 46 Richardson Highway, he has done prospecting and guiding. He mushed dog for years, then learned to fly after deciding dogs wouldn't cover Alaska fast enough. He married Mildred Harkness in 1932, and they have four children. He joined Igloo number 4 in February 1958, and he currently operates a guiding service. As we say, Bob is not with us today. Another person who is not with us today, who's in Fairbanks, but was unable to come out, was Charles J. McGrath. Charlie was born on the 11th of May, 1909, in Fairbanks. His home for many years, the 800-acre homestead combination in the McGrath Road area, was well known for the potatoes they grew. And his father, Charles, was known as the Alaska Potato King. He recalls helping his dad in the fields from about the time he was 6 years of age, and also that clearing the ground and putting in roads were up to the owners in those days and took a lot of hard work. With his wife Dorothy, who was a nurse, they alternated their time for many years between winters in town, Fairbanks, and summers on the homestead. In later years, Charlie worked at the power plant at Ladd Field. In recent years, Charlie has wintered in Seattle, the Claremont Hotel, but returns to Fairbanks for the summer. Now with us today also are again royalty from Anchorage, and I'm very happy to introduce to you the King and Queen Regent, Fred and Irene Braun. Fred came to Anchorage in 1934, and Irene arrived there in 1935. They were married in 1937, and they have made Alaska their home ever since. Fine, if you'd stand, please. Hey, you got to keep standing there for a minute. You got flowers coming. It's a pleasure to introduce our grand officers. Today we have four, and maybe five by the time the introductions are finished, we'll see. First to it, we'd like to introduce the grand recorder, Mrs. Vera Siders. Vera was born in Girdwood, and Vera, I for some reason didn't find the exact date. It might have had something to do that you're the keeper of the record. But at any rate, you were born in Girdwood not so many years ago. And you've been resided in Fairbanks for 26 years.
She married Harry Siders in 1968 and joined Auxiliary Number 8 in 1953 and was president of that organization in 1959. She owns a bookkeeping service, is local as well as state treasurer for the business and professional women, and in October 1972, she was elected Grand Recorder of the Grand Igloo. Let's give Vera a hand. Grand Sergeant-at-Arms, Robert L. Huffman. Bob was born in Anchorage, Alaska, moved to Fairbanks with his parents in 1930. He joined the Igloo in 1961, is a past president, and in October 1972 was elected Grand Sergeant-at-Arms for a one-year term. In addition to the normal duties of that office, it also goes that whenever you need anything done or need of a favor of any kind, get in touch with Bob Huffman. His secretaries give him good protection, but you can always find a way through. Bob. Now, the next person you see before we get to Adolf is our grand trustee. You better go over and sit down, Bill, so we can... Bill Schaefer was born in Missouri and first came to Ketchikan, Alaska in 1924. He left but returned in the early 30s. He arrived in Fairbanks in 1943. He is past president of Igloo Number 4, life member, and last October was elected to terms of 3 years as grand trustees. And we can say about Bill, we'll take a look at the boutonniere he's getting. He was in charge of getting the flowers, so I'm sure that he's got an appropriate one. Stand, please, don't. You've sat long enough, come over and go to work again. Past Grand President Adolf Stock joined the Igloo in February 1952. He's a life member, past president, and was Grand President in 1969. During the past year, he was King Regent, and his wife Mary was Queen Regent. Yesterday, I heard that Adolf spent his time between checking the cabin, chopping wood, and doing a little sawing in the meantime. Adolf. Also pleased to present to you the Grand Chaplain, and this is Robert Hansen from Anchorage. Bob is Vice President of Revolution Airways. He was born in Fairbanks, and last year he was King Regent from Anchorage. Give Bob, you'll stand, we'll give you a big hand here. Two members of the State Pioneer Home Advisory Board, Leslie Nerland and Alden Wilbur, are not with us at the moment. Perhaps momentarily they will be. Now, Auxiliary Number 8, Pioneers of Alaska, was organized in 1947 and first officers were installed on January 5th, 1948. Representing this very active group is this year's president, Mrs. Angela Garrity. Angie was born in Yugoslavia. She came to Fairbanks as the bride of Nick Borovich, who passed away after a lingering illness. Their daughters Olga Carson and Vera Matherly both reside in Fairbanks, and Nikki Elliott lives in Wasilla. Angie became the wife of Clyde Garrity in 1950, and they have two sons, Mike, a senior at the University of Hawaii, and Steve, a senior at Lathrop. Angie joined Auxiliary Number 8 in January of 1948, and is a charter member and life member. Angie Garrity. Our Queen Regent, Fairbanks, 1973, Lena Phipps. Lena was born in Mount Olive, North Carolina. She first arrived in Alaska at Seward when she came for just a visit, coming to Fairbanks in July of 1928. She lived at Good Pasture from 1928 to 1937, and I'm sure that was quite an experience, returning to Fairbanks in 1937. She married Oscar Phipps in April 1952. She has one daughter, Frances Cerrito, She lives with her sister, Lila King, on 11th Avenue. She joined the auxiliary May 5th, 1952, and is a life member. Okay? Queen Regent, please. King Regent, 1973, Lee Eugene Link. And I think the way that we identify the King Regent is Jack. Jack was born in Oakville, Illinois in December 1892. He landed in Alaska at Seward in early 1928 and in Fairbanks in April and has been a resident of the state since then. Jack was an accountant with the Fairbanks Exploration Company for 30 years, business manager of the school district for 8 years, and recently retired for the third time, having held the position of director of the Fairbanks Pioneers Home from its opening. He and his wife, the former Alaska Stuart Moody, continue to live in Fairbanks. To share golden days with them this year, they are joined by their children, Helen Atkinson, Shirley Carlson, Lee Link, and Jim Moody. Don Link, who resides in California, unable to be present this year. Jack, you'd stand, please. Now, in addition, we are very happy to welcome back home those Alaskans who now reside in other states. And at this time of the program goes completely haywire. I start to introduce somebody and somebody else needs an introduction and so it goes. But at this stage of the game, I'd like every visitor that we have from outside of the state, former residents of Alaska, to stand or raise their hand. Now, stand. I can see you. Okay. Keep standing. And if you keep standing now, until you give your name and where you live, and then sit down. And we'll start over here with Dorothy.
Dorothy Loft is now Coos Bay, Oregon.
Okay. Minnie Monroe, Pioneer Home. Good, Minnie. Okay, now sit down.
Myrtle Adler.
Redmond, Washington.
Don Adler, same place.
Same place. Must be some connection there. Okay, we got the point. And there was somebody, yes. Frank Nash, Seattle. Ooh. Past president of Igloo 4. Okay. Are there any others now that we've missed? Yes, this gentleman here. Oh, fine. Good. Okay. Oh, yes. That was Beth Hickman. You're Claire Russ' sister. Okay, all right, now we're all organized there. Real fine. Oh, yes, we have you, Mrs. Fine, thank you, Mrs. F. Fitch. And who's the fellow next to you? You. That was the same place over here. Okay. Pretty close. There. All right. We'll not go into that anymore. Anybody else? This is your opportunity. Okay. Now we'll continue with the program. If you think of somebody between now and the conclusion, don't hesitate to let us know somewhere along the way. Our speaker today is H.E. Elton Busby, a pioneer in every sense of the word. Elton was born in Fairbanks, one of four boys on one of the first homesteads in the area. His father mined at Nome from 1889 to 1900. with the family moving to Skagway in 1902. They moved to Fairbanks in 1905 and established the first fur farm in Interior, Alaska in 1907. He married Elizabeth Washoe in November 1940, and they have four children. With the exception of about 6 years while he attended school in the lower 48, he has been in Alaska prospecting, trading, fur buying, trapping, farming, and guiding. Elton retired in March 1973 after working for the University of Alaska for 13 years in the physical plant. His days are busy even in retirement with prospecting and his hobby of gardening. For those of you that have seen his hobby of gardening, I think most of us would say it's a full-time enterprise, but he seems to put it in and goes and things grow. He also has a talent for putting on canvas much of the beauty of Alaska as he sees it, which is shared and very much appreciated by many people. His main interest has always been people. He believes only people busy producing new wealth from natural resources can assure that the state will continue as a good place for future generations of people of Alaska and the world to make their home. Also, I know that Elton has passed through this valley, I'm sure many, many times, but I think of one time in particular. I wasn't here at the time to observe the trip through, but as I understand it, Elton, as a young boy, with his father, came this way with a wagon load of vegetables for sale. Their target was Chattanooga. I understand, however, they did not reach Clary City because partway down the slope, the last of the vegetables had been sold. Certainly, this is indicative of the group of people that Elton represents. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Harry Elton Busby, who will speak on the subject, farming in Interior Alaska. Elton?
Thank you, Mr. Toastmaster, King and Queen Regent, and the King and Queen Regent of Anchorage, distinguished guests, and their old friends from out of the state, particular welcome, ladies and gentlemen. That little flowery start that Dr. Beislein made kind of interrupted my start of my little talk I was going to make. I was going to mention that it was 57 years ago in August that we made that trip. My brother Bob is also with me, but mainly we got our first caribou on that trip because we went on to Coffee Dome from the summit, beautiful weather, and out of the bottom of the wagon in a bedroll and horse blankets and so forth, it was a 22 and a 30-30, which the dad let us kids use, and his own gun, and we got our first caribou, and we learned a tremendous lesson. Only take what you can use. There was lots of caribou, but we were only allowed one. The trip was very good because on the way back we got an order for a gin pole and some mine timber delivered after freezing. This valley through here, as I recall, was full of tents, cabins, gin poles here and there sticking up, boiler houses, and hundreds of men and women. They were all busy. There was wood hauling, there was mining, and there was building going on, and even here and there throughout the hillside, there was berry picking going on. Another notable thing that we don't see today was the plume one on top of another in some places, which took the water as it was available and flumed it to where it was run into the sluice boxes to recover the gold from the gravel that was hoisted up from bedrock. We'll come back to this area, I think, after a while for a moment. Many of you are aware of many of the farmers, settlers of this area. The number was mentioned today. Our good neighbor, Charlie Kramer, and his family. Charlie McGrath, and others. You remember George Gasser and Minner? And the Bentleys, for instance. I'd like to give a few highlights of what I remember about some of the people here in the early days. George Gasser has, of course, done some wonderful work in the Rampart area over on the Yukon before coming to Fairbanks and raising crops. And he was very noted for his barley, which carries his name. It has been a great success here. 7 good years, full years out of 8 trials is remarkable for this northern area. And Mrs. Gasser was well known for her identification and classification of wildflowers. First, I believe, it was attempted in the civilian capacity in all of Alaska. He was in charge of the experimental station here in Fairbanks for a number of years and later taught at the university. Dr. Brinsmaid will be remembered for his development of a hullless and he was quite disappointed when he took a load of these oats out to General Mills and various other places and found out that he was developed them 50 years too soon or 50 years too late, because the machinery that is used for making rolled oats and other things are geared and manufactured for an oat with hulls on it. And economically, why, they couldn't very well change the machinery and use this particular oat. And other fantastic things that was done. Charlie Kramer, when he took over the Hinckley Dairy, and it was not mentioned that he also had the largest dairy in all of the state of Alaska, and I think that still holds to this date, that his operations was the largest, and orderly, and a very fine operation. Many of us will remember Paul and Stacia Rickert, Fairbanks Gardens, where now I think the main airport road that is recently built at 14th and Cushman, beautiful big greenhouse, and their crew, and acres of fine vegetables. Paul was also recognized in the early days as Mr., I think you would call it Chamber of Commerce now, commercial club in those days. And M.D. Snodgrass, now the family is still in Alaska, most of and people are well aware of his getting the amount of land for the university under the original land grant for colleges. They're aware that he was instrumental, I believe, mostly in the development of colonization in the Palmer area. There's few that remember that when he was in charge of the Kodiak station, Kodiak Island, that he commandeered a steamer and evacuated safely without any injury of any kind the island of Kodiak when Mount Katmai was throwing tons and tons and tons of ashes, volcanic ash, over the whole area. August and Jesse Biermark,
had a very nice operation. And there was adjoined the Ricketts place, which is now probably the central of area of South Fairbanks. And one thing in mentioning about Charlie and his dad, Jim McGrath, that I believe was not mentioned, was that they were the first to actually demonstrate here that select seed and use of the new commercial fertilizers could develop the potato that the discriminating housewife insisted upon. Restaurants with fine chefs like Tom Ewell, for instance, insisted that only the McGrath baking potato be used on their menus. These are outstanding contributions. And Lou Joy. Lou Joy, his family came here in 1915 after many years in Skagway. And located out the Richardson Highway. A lot of people remember Lou best as having served for nearly 30 years as on the school board and refusing at any time to ever receive 5 cents compensation. That's a contribution that not too many people would be willing to make today. Lou Homestead took over the Otto Hoppe Homestead. Now, some might recall Otto Hoppe as a teacher of music. He homesteaded first in 1907 out on the Richardson Highway, but knowing him intimately as a teacher, as a tutor, and skilled in mathematics, for instance. Few knew that Otto had done much work. Skagway, and located out the Richardson Highway. A lot of people remember Lou best as having served for nearly 30 years as on the school board and refusing at any time to ever receive 5 cents compensation. That's a contribution that not too many people would be willing to make today. Lou Homestead took over the Otto Hoppe Homestead. Now, some might recall Otto Hoppe as a teacher of music. He homesteaded first in 1907 out on the Richardson Highway, but knowing him intimately as a teacher, as a tutor, and skilled in mathematics, for instance. Few knew that Otto had done much work in compiling translation of the Bible into the Eskimo language in the Arctic prior, many, many years prior to coming to Fairbanks. He came up to Yukon here and landed here as an auditor for the old DC company or the NC company, one of those organizations when they were locating here in Fairbanks. But I remember Otto for the work that he done in taking the Swiss chard and determining that growth would respond to good music and kind words. I'm sure that that will be looked into by some of the scientists sometime in the near future. But this is what I think is has been the one thing that we have liked gardening, because this is a fact. That's so help me. The plants will also respond oppositely to cussing and damnation and so forth. And that, of course, is a fact. George Dana might be remembered as the operator of the flour mill in the last few years when it was in operation. And, of course, Paul Dryman should be remembered for
his work and being skilled in seeing that there was machinery that could harvest wheat to be milled in this flour mill that we had here. And of course, Paul, while he had to be relieved of his original place, is now owns the Jack Horn homestead, which is on the Badger Road. So he, and I had a visit with Paul and his wife the other day, very enjoyable moments, and he's just as interested in agriculture today, I'm sure, as he was in those days. We must remember Tom Tonsis, I think, senior, and his daughter, Amanda Hansen, is here today, and the grandson, Robert Hansen, of the Igloo 15 in Anchorage is here. But they homesteaded up the Chena River, where they had to go by boat at a time when power boats was not too dependable, and they had it picked out a beautiful place. Today, that's the pride and joy of Dr. Dury, who heads the University of Alaska Experimental Station. I don't think we should forget Grant Courtney, who had the homestead there at the mouth of the Little Chena during World War I. One of the things that was outstanding that Grant had done was supply over 100 tons of hay, that it's a matter of record, for government horses and mules that was here at a time when rationing was far more severe than it was in World War II, and due to a lack of transportation and so forth. These are contributions that some of the people might not might know, but might tend to forget, that is very important. Frank Betjart experimented with fruit trees and fir farming. I think that he was probably one of those skilled most in this area in Martin, wonderful fir. And Frank Betjart realized his one dream close to shortly before he passed on, and that was to fly in one of these whirligigs. And by golly, they came over to his place and took him over to Thanksgiving dinner at Ladd Field, Fort Wainwright, in a whirligig, as he called it. So everything had been accomplished that he had wanted to see done. There were many others. I'm thinking of Jimmy Weiss. Many of you might recall Jimmy. Few, I believe, had a chance to get into his place because it was pretty near impossible to get to his place. It's now most of his acreage and place is covered up where the east end of Fort Wainwright runway, where they had to take the hill, which is on part of his property, and remove the top of it so planes could land on Fort Wainwright runways safely. But Jimmy took various raspberries and crossed them and with tame, or with our wild raspberries, and developed a product that was just so much in demand that it's a shame that these things were lost, you know. Oh, there were many others. Hoagie on 3rd and 4th and Hovel Street, for instance, in downtown Fairbanks, that raised roses that was, for special occasions, couldn't be, the roses couldn't be duplicated anywhere else. The Russells, Jim Russell and his family, they had a homestead out 21 mile on the old Richardson Highway, which has been discontinued in a number of years, and he called it the three-star Hennessy Farm, and it was well named. A fine gentleman. And Scotty Haldane, that used to have his homestead out in the Tanana River, or some of it is in the Tanana by now, or else it's been built up on bars. Scotty was a real bag pipe playing character that everybody appreciated. He was a wonderful person. Barney Everman out and his wife out on Engineer Creek over here. Mustn't be forgotten. And Billy Boardman. People will remember Henry Berry. And Klaus Johnson. Sicotti. Surely somebody will remember Sicotti. Raised foxes as well as a garden, and he made damn poor whiskey. And the Lozelle family. The Lozelle family, most of them were very prominent in Alaska today. And Walter Crick and his partner, Harry Badger, who was known as the Strawberry King. And a neighbor of ours was at our house yesterday, brought us a pineapple that they'd got from Hawaii, very delicious. And it was telling us how happy they were that they finally got some of Harry Badger's strawberries, and they were going to really go to town and develop these strawberries. And I think that's a tribute to the work that they've done. They were excellent. The McIntyres, they had a very highly developed farm right close to what is now, I think, called the suburban area of the town of Fairbanks. Blaine Lake is named after Blaine. Quite a place in the early days. Fred Johnson. Fred had a place on Johnson Subdivision, I believe they call it now, on College Road. But he was probably most noted as a legislator, a good legislator. And McCluskey. Some might remember the McCluskeys at homesteaded 320 acres out by Richardson Roadhouse. Their roadhouse and beautiful building that they built in those days was moved into Fairbanks, and I think that it's still up there near the state office building, or it might have been torn down to build the state office building, somewhere in that direction. And in some of the out-of-the-way areas, well, let's mention Fred Clinton. I don't know how many people remember Fred Clinton. He lived back of Jack Horn's and a very fine man. He had a beautiful team, and that was his pride and joy. But he was the one man that I know that went through a whole lifetime up here and made whiskey, real good whiskey, and never got caught or even suspicion of getting caught. I don't think that he made this whiskey to sell, but to give to his friends. Because I remember one time, somebody in our home was ill. Here comes Fred with a bottle of whiskey. It's excellent. And there was one little thing I should mention. Jack Horn, who has the homestead that Paul Graham owns now. If I'm boring you, I holler if I have to quit, if time stops. Otherwise, I'd like to mention a few of these things, if it's all right. But Fred used to, in the spring, have quite a little accumulation of grain, leftover grain, or worked over grain, I guess you'd call it mash. Mashes, maybe we'd say. And the damn bear would come there, and they'd fill up on that and get drunk and then go over and bother Jack Horn. Jack was a real character. I wish I could tell you some of the stories, but time don't permit. The O'Connors on College Road were another prominent people that I can remember. And the Macaulay Greenhouse, which later was taken over by Jacob, there where the Travelers Inn now sits, supplied. These people were supplying a need that you could not get in any other way. There was no other way it could be had. And we had some characters here, too. I remember many of you recall Dave Atwell. Next year, he was going to plant 20 acres of spuds instead of 5, but he never quite got to it. And John the Bear Hunter. Now, I don't know what his name is. I think Charlie Kramer might remember, or someone else might recall. Maybe Mrs. Rust might remember, but he ridiculed some people for clearing off land. What the hell do you want to do that for? He went out on the bank of the Tanana River where there was a nice lush grass growing and homesteaded. Well, he started to homestead, let me put it that way. He was about 10 mile on the Richardson Highway. He was a fine man, liked him very well, especially good to us kids and telling us all kinds of good stories. But his idea was, why work when here's something already prepared? So he planted his garden on this river mud bar, and the elements was against him. Water came up, and that was the end of his mining work. He went back to bear hunting, I guess. And, of course, Jack Horn, who was one of my favorite characters, and his brother Bob, they operated for many years. Well, first of all, when they came to the country, if I remember correctly, they were both pugilists. One was a little punch drunk. And they built a steamer, and they at one time, I remember, they hauled freight from Fairbanks up the Wild River Slough and to Richardson Roadhouse, and back. And on the way back, they'd bring a load of wood. And it was a galloping cow, and I believe the relics of that, the last I seen of it, was on the bar, pretty well up in the brush by now, if it hasn't been cleared to build a home. About halfway between Jack's old place and Harry Badger place on that bend in the slough. Pretty near dry now. And Mike Biddle. Many of you remember Mike, who here a few years ago was a great, he went into the hog business. Well, he had a farmer neighbor who raised a lot of potatoes, good potatoes. And Mike had, I think, about 65 head of hogs. And I remember the hogs would get out of his fence, if you could call it a fence. And of course, if they headed for the Lawrence Field, Mike would go looking for them in the opposite direction for a couple hours. I remember he stopped in at the house when he was looking for his pegs. These pegs couldn't get to my place. They wouldn't swim that stream there. And they surely would stay off the highway. And he pulled a little bottle of Mickey out of his pocket, and he says, "Would you have a drink?" And I guess maybe I'm not a drinking man, but I might have smelled it before. But anyway, I said, "That's pretty good." "Oh," he says, "I can make the finest whiskey, Busby, but I got no time." And Mike was kind of pretty clever at that, because these plugs for the time, but these hogs for the time he rounded them up would usually have Lawrence pretty wild, chasing him around his field, or they'd usually get quite a bunch of good spuds to eat. St. Louis used to be driving a team down the highway in the old days with wood. And he'd usually make a late start, and it was long towards midnight by the time he'd get towards town, but he'd always be singing La Belle Marie, Le Jumatois, that's French Canadian for Mary Had a Little Lamb. And then there was Tom White. Many of you might recall Tom White. A genius, and he was known as the Little Giant. And he was just ahead of his time. And we might laugh about some of his escapades or some of his work, but we shouldn't. And I'll tell you why in a moment. But he started not a little ranch, but a big ranch to enclose caribou up on the head of the North Fork. That's near the, between the Chino Hot Springs and Chattanooga, to raise caribou. They wouldn't let anybody raise reindeer. And he built a lot of fence, hauled in a lot of wire. And some of his fences, the ones that I seen, was a beautiful fence. I mean, it was high, but for some reason the caribou would jump the fence. Now, maybe it was because of snowdrifts, or maybe it's just because they can jump. And I wish there was an oil conservation man type man here that could listen to that, because I have seen them jump, and this 4 foot high pike means nothing to a moose or a caribou that I know, and I'll take an oath on it. But anyway, this particular operation had to fold finally because you've just no way to keep the caribou in. Now, I say we shouldn't laugh about this because he was doing this by financing his own way without government subsidy, and along about that same period, the old biological survey was doing pretty near the same thing down in the Healy, trying to enclose caribou, and they found they couldn't do it either, only they were going to use reindeer to cross with the caribou. They had a little bit of the advantage over Tom because not only did they have the finances, but they also had the reindeer, which Tom couldn't get. But the best of the characters, I think, was Jack Brown. And he always liked to get, like Amanda's, he lived up near Amanda Hansen's place, only on the opposite side of the river, next to the Courtney's, a short distance from there. And Jack always made it a point, if he says Courtney, he'd correct himself and say Kootenai. If he says, I was talking with Tom Thompson, he'd correct himself and say, I was talking with Tom Thompson. Everybody's name had to be the way he wanted it to be. When the Volstead Act took effect here, Jack was moaning and groaning because the government was taking away his rum. And then they'd take away his tobacco, and what would be left? So he sent down to Kentucky. We had quite a nice little greenhouse at that time, and brought a bunch of seed up and had to start these plants. He didn't have a greenhouse on his place up in China. To raise tobacco, which he did. He raised big burly tobacco, and the damn stuff was up that high, and the leaves, monstrous big leaves, on one type of ground, and they'd be skinny and small leaves on the other, and this was two different kinds of tobacco, but they came from the same seed. I never quite understood that, but this is the way it worked out. Well, Jack watched these like a hawk, and when they were ripe for picking, he was the one that had to pick them and hang them to dry under the shade and smoke them a little bit. It was a special secret formula that he had, using birch or something, or willows. Then he bored a hole after a time in birch trees, and used an inch and a half auger, I know because I still have a piece of one of the trees that he split out. And he would put some molasses, and that had to be blackstrap. That's the only kind of work. A little salt, and he'd pound these leaves into this hole in the birch tree, and then put a plug on it. And then in case the damn government took his tobacco away from him, well, he was going to be all right. Now, to get away from this rum situation, he got some charred kegs, good kegs, and he chopped up potatoes. And it looked like an endless job. And then he had to use his blackstrap again, a certain kind. No other would do. And he tamped for spuds in the keg and also the molasses. And then he borrowed a big manure pile, which happened to be, we had a bunch of horses at that time, and buried it in the bottom so that it wouldn't freeze, so that come spring, why, he'd have his rum. But George Weber tested that one time and said, not rum. Look at his hand, not rum. It might be some kind of a vodka, but not rum. So much for the characters. I'm just wondering what you would, the people would call Garden Islands there today if it hadn't been for Margaret Brandt and her homestead and the Zender that had the beautiful garden and flowers, or what Slaterville would be called today if Charlie Slater hadn't developed a farm there. Same way goes out the highway and down in the college area. What would happen? I mean, what in the world would a real estate man do today to help further inflation if they didn't have these pioneers do this preliminary work. Another outstanding fact that I would like to mention at this time, and I mentioned it already to Dr. Davis, was that these people were conservationists. They were very clean. When they came into public areas, they took time to trim their shaggy beards if they did happen to have a beard. Because they realized that an unkept beard didn't make man a conservationist. They were conservationists because they saved soil. I don't ever remember of anyone ever destroying any soil. And trees. They took pride in selecting trees that was going to be used future purposes of building. And they trim them up, trim the dead limbs off so they could expand and the underbrush would be cleaned up so that the tree could expand and grow. And that's conservation. And that's what we should be practicing today. As far as salvaging or saving for future generations a bunch of dead trees falling down in some forest and calling that conservation in any way is the farthest thing from the truth, regardless of where it comes from. These are all great men and women coming into an area where there was no book written about what they should do. They had to do this work themselves. Hard to find words to describe. But I believe that we could use you will call Paul's message to Timothy in 2 Timothy 1:7, which says, "For God did not give man a spirit of timidity, but a spirit of power and love and self-control." And I think this best describes the people that came in here, pioneered settling and agriculture and mining too, for that matter, all businesses in this area. They weren't timid. They were courageous. They were unafraid. They were unafraid to touch this delicate tundra and make it productive. And that was for the betterment of all people, regardless of color, creed, or place of origin. And they loved the land. It wasn't a matter of being a friend of the land. It was a matter of loving the land. And they loved their fellow men, and they loved their work. And they had the self-control needed to overcome years of toil without harm to others. And that was important. And to experiment and to withstand rather harsh disappointments from time to time, and knowing the thrill of leaving land in better shape for future.